for joining us on Holy Family Radio for Faith and Reason, where we connect culture and ideas to the daily lives of Catholics. I'm Dr. John Pinero, Associate Professor of History and Director of Catholic Studies at Aquinas College in Grand Rapids, Michigan. And today we'll be talking with Connor Dugan. We'll be talking about contemplation and the law. Welcome to the show, Connor.
John, thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
Connor is counsel at Varnum Attorneys at Law in Grand Rapids, Michigan, where he is trial and appellate law attorney and a member of the Litigation and Trial Services Practice Group. Connor's focus is on commercial litigation as well as bankruptcy and labor and employment law. Formerly a clerk for Judge Samuel Alito, Connor also worked for a time at the Department of Justice. And so we might be wondering, well, why is Connor here to talk about contemplation? Well, contemplation and the law. Connor gave an address recently to the Catholic Lawyers Association of West Michigan. I should point out before we continue further that Connor earned his AB in government from Dartmouth College and his law degree from the University of Notre Dame. That's one of the other Catholic colleges in this area, isn't it, besides Aquinas College?
Yeah, it's not quite up there with Aquinas.
A little further to the south, yeah. Yes. Okay, well, I guess I'd like to start off with What an attorney's typical day is like. As you probably know, and I know my sister works at a law office in Madison, and she tells me that if a law office's day was even a third of interesting as a television show or a courtroom drama, that would be great, but not so much.
I think your sister's right.
In her case, so I'm wondering what your typical day is like. And because we all, I hope, Catholics listening and non-Catholics listening want to look for moments in our day where there's silence or time for prayer and wondering how we fit that in. And the modern world seems busier than the world 200 years ago, but none of us were alive then. Maybe they felt the same way,
yeah.
Right? And but we'll use you as an example based on that talk you gave. So what would your normal day be like?
Yeah, no, I would say, John, that it's typically untypical or atypical in a sense that every day can kind of present its own challenges. A client could call first thing, which you may have had that first hour blocked off to read a brief or something like that, and a client calls and you've got to deal with the question that's pressing there for the client. It might involve reading a brief, getting that client call, then going out at lunchtime and meeting with a prospective client and getting to know someone and his or her business and finding out really what the legal needs of that particular person is. And then you might come back and you might have to draft up a complaint for another client who's unfortunately embroiled in a loss or in a contentious situation and now needs to bring a lawsuit. You might go upstairs for a committee meeting or something like that. It seems like we all are involved in committees.
No one told me that in graduate school, that half of being a professor, it seems, is going to committee meetings.
Yeah.
I'm sorry to hear that about your.
Yeah, no, there are a lot of them are interesting and they're mm-hmm. for sort of larger purposes for the firm or for the legal field, but there are things like that eat up the day, and they're also I'm married and have kids, and that's why I'm calling and talking with my wife during the day, catching up and trying to deal with questions that are looming on the home front. So it's really, I would say, a lawyer's day can be very broken up with things, and then there's the added dimension that I'm sitting in front of a computer all day. Most of my research is done on the internet. Not all of it. We still have a library and do things with the books, and actually like that, prefer that if I can get into them. But also I'm having to respond to emails and write things on Word. So everything is sort of there right in front of the computer. And I think, like many people, I deal with the challenges of having Facebook or my Gmail or whatever it may be. And some idea occurs to me, and I think, oh, I'll Google that. And you end up spending 10 minutes doing something that you hadn't intended to do. So I think that's a real challenge, probably for anyone who's at a desk job and has that internet connection and the computer.
It's easy to be distracted.
Yeah, it's right there.
Sure.
But, you know, I would say sort of the bulk of my job involves reading and writing and researching. I do a lot of crafting of arguments and legal briefs and things like that. And I do a lot of research that goes into preparing the arguments that I'm going to put down on paper. I typically write things directly into Word. Sometimes I dictate them. That's something a lot of the older attorneys do, and I found that it's effective for some things for me. And then after I get a draft, I often will take and sit away from the computer and just start to tear it apart by hand and write things by hand. I guess if I had to boil it down to what I do, and I think it depends on what sort of sections of the law you're involved in, but for me in litigation, especially with the appellate litigation I'm doing, a lot of it is research and writing. And so much of my day is spent reading and writing, which I really enjoy. So it's and there's a silence that's sort of built into that in a way. But then again, there's always the constant possibility of being distracted by the computer, and then their colleagues. You want to talk and catch up with your colleagues and be a good colleague, and so those sorts of distractions distractions is the wrong word because I don't want to have a negative connotation, but those are things that take you away from your work.
Sure. Yeah, and it sounds like in that kind of work you have to be sharp and your mind's working constantly. And so while we'll get to the topic of contemplation in a moment, but I recall reading any number of sources, Buddhist and Christian, that'll talk about throwing yourself into the work of washing dishes, sweeping a floor, and that kind of repetitive labor is one thing when you're doing contemplation. But if you're having to work your way through different laws and the overlapping jurisdictions, whatever it is you're working with, then that must be quite difficult that must be quite a challenge to try to set that aside. I'm just wondering I guess what I'm getting at is what are some particular difficulties you think you would face that are specific to being an attorney? Many people nowadays are going to face the computer problem. I face it. I mean, I'm in the classroom a lot. I write books and articles too, but I'm also near the computer a lot. I communicate with my students all the time. The iPad's been a big help, but on the other hand, it's a big hindrance too.
right,
there it is. I need to get a holster for it.
Yeah.
I think sometimes just to carry it around. So all of us have, I think, temptations or perils in our specific job. So what might be specific to yours?
Well, and I think you started to hint at it that it's not maybe like sweeping the floor. Or I worked in a fuel injector factory back in college, and you could leave the factory floor and kind of turn it off. You didn't have to worry about it. But I'm often thinking about the sort of the knotty legal question that's in front of me.
Does that take days?
It can take days. It can take weeks. And it's not like I can neatly cabin it off.
You can only think of it between 9 and 5 or something. Sure.
So that doesn't happen. And so I actually think that's one reason why the topic for lawyers, but for everyone in contemplation, is so important, because there needs to be – you need to find a way to sort of clear out space to be with God, to contemplate the face of Christ. And I think that prayer and contemplation are never an instrumental thing, of course, but they do, I think, have this side benefit that they can kind of help when you have to turn the mind on. And again, you can't really turn it off, but when you really need to go at it, if you've given your space, yourself some space and time to just be with the Lord, I think it can help you when you then have to turn back to your task. I was having lunch recently with a broker, an investment guy, and he says he actually sets aside an hour every day just to think. He stays away from the computer, stays away from the phone, and spends time just to let his mind have that space to think about the investments that he's
making. An hour a day.
Yeah, I think he's pretty, if you will, religious about it, and making sure that he gives himself that time. And people are always asking him about it, but he's sort of it's a non-negotiable for him, and he thinks that it allows him to sort of be more present when he's in the office. But he usually is in the morning. He said, I give myself that hour in the morning. He calls it his think time.
Okay. So this isn't a holy hour, or
it isn't. No, yeah. I mean that, I think this would be an addition to something like that. But that, you know, I think so much of it is about, and we're sort of dancing around, and we'll get more into it, but so much of it is about space and time, just making it. And I have to say that I'm sure that's a struggle for everyone. It's a big struggle for me with, you know, being married and having kids and also being in the law. And I think you really need to be disciplined. I'm more and more convinced, though I'm not, that doesn't mean I'm doing more and more about it, but I'm more and more convinced I really need to make that time in the morning. Because if I don't do it in the morning, it seems it's like it's never going to happen. Oh, I'll get to adoration at 3 p.m. It does it when you kind of set it aside. It's the same with exercise.
I wonder if it's children that lead you to that conclusion, because now that we have Lucia at home, I tend to think that's probably the best time, because if she's getting me up at 4:30 in the morning anyway, and then I can kind of tuck her back in an hour later, not only I might as well stay up, but I'm just not going to get that time in the evening.
Yeah.
And I'm going to be starting to droop around 7 or 8 anyway, and keep pushing that into the morning. I never could understand men before who would go to a prayer breakfast at 5:30 a.m. in the morning. I thought, who gets up and does that? And I thought, I think I could do that now.
Yeah.
I could do that.
Well, and I think it's also capturing those downtimes. Like I've been trying to be more conscious about this when I'm cuddling with my kids, when my kids are and I are simply with each other but not saying anything. I'm trying to use that time just to clear out the clutter and just let Christ be present. And I think that's really important, because you can't. If you're living in the world, you have a secular job in the secular world. It's not you're not necessarily on the monastic schedule where you have you're waking up and you're going to be saying morning prayer with your brothers at the same time, or if you're in a religious group of religious sisters with your sisters, you need to find those times that you can capture to make your own, and maybe that goes a little bit back to what you were talking about it in terms of the person who's sweeping or something like this. While you're sweeping, you're able to give yourself over to prayer. While you're cuddling with your kids and they're falling asleep, and maybe you're falling asleep, but you can kind of try to keep yourself awake and use that time, because it's otherwise I find it very difficult to find that time. And part of it is being, again, disciplined in making it. And my wife would be the first to attest that I don't have the strongest willpower, and so that's something I need to work on and sharpen that. And I think partly, you know, I'm sure you've had spiritual directors or people, spiritual fathers you've talked with who've told you this, but starting out small, too. I think that I definitely struggle with the idea I'm just going to reform it all. I'm going to set a schedule. I'm going to do
a revolution in your life. Yeah,
the New Year's coming, and I'm going to do an hour of adoration every day. I'm going to do mass at lunchtime. I'm going to do morning prayer, evening prayer, and you find out, you know, a week into it, you're basically like not hitting any of those, and you feel like a failure. And that doesn't mean we shouldn't aim big, but I think there's something wise in the idea of let's start with small steps. If it's waking up 15 minutes early and giving before anyone else in the house, and giving yourself that time just to be silent. And it's I'm sure you, John, have this. Well, maybe you don't. You're holier than I am.
Oh, and let's not go there.
But just the tendency to get into prayer and you start just asking for things. It's very easy to become a sort of a chatterbug when you get it, even when you get that time to pray. So I think really trying, when you're given those opportunities, just to say, I'm going to be quiet.
And I think that, you know, it's a good segue into talking about what contemplation is then, because it's a lot of listening and not a lot of talking. And you also mentioned the monastic orders and the monastic the rhythm to the day that monks had, the 7 times a day at least at one time. And I think some listeners might be thinking, well, contemplation is good for monks, and you know, it's good for the few who were called to it, but it's not for me. I have the kind of day maybe that you just described, and it's all I can do. I'm like, if I say a decade of the rosary, or I'll say some prayers from memory, but at least I'm praying, or I have a few minutes to read the Mass readings, and that's all it seems I can get. But Thomas Merton said, to quote him, he said that contemplation is the highest expression of man's intellectual and spiritual life. And if he's right, then it's something we're always working toward, and we might want to admit that it's better than what I'm doing now. And it's not only different, maybe it is elevated, maybe it's something we really want to aim to, just sensing God's presence. So why don't you tell us and our listeners, what is contemplation? I've read several books of Merton's, and he can't really answer the question beyond writing a book, and then he'll write another one. I mean, we're talking about ineffable things here, and you can describe it in all sorts of ways, but there is no pithy definition that one can offer. But if we talk about what contemplation is, to make sure our listeners and me, you, that we're all kind of on the same page here.
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think Merton wrote all those books because it's easy to sort of dance around and see the edges of it, but what the sort of heart of contemplation is difficult. I want to get to that question. I think I want to just address one thing you were saying, that temptation that we all have to say, well, that's really for monks. That's really... they're the ones who have the time and sort of the vocation to do that. Well, Merton is saying, and in the talk that I gave to the Catholic lawyers down in Kalamazoo, I quoted Joseph Pieper, the great Catholic philosopher, talking about the fact that sort of the true happiness consists, man's ultimate happiness, Pieper says, consists in contemplation. And so this isn't just for somebody who's in the monastic vocation. This is for everybody. This is something we all need. And so what is contemplation? And getting to that, it's difficult. And I think actually turning to the catechism is a good place. Quoting, the catechism talks about contemplation being the gaze of faith fixed on Jesus. And then it uses St. Teresa of Avila's definition of contemplative prayer as being, quote, nothing else than a close sharing between friends. It means taking time frequently to be alone with him who we know loves us. And so really what St. Teresa is saying there is that contemplative prayer just means letting Christ be present. And I think it really is a clearing out of those questions and simply making space for silence so that Christ can speak his word. Pope Benedict said, silence is the environmental condition most conducive to contemplation, to listening to God and to meditation. The very fact of enjoying silence and letting ourselves be filled, so to speak, with silence disposes us to prayer. So I think at the root, contemplation really is a letting be. And that sounds abstract, and maybe we should try to make it more concrete, but if we think of it in our relationships with our family, how important is it for us simply to sit there, and you do this with your wife, and I do this with my wife, just to listen, just to hear how her day went, to understand what her concerns are, what are the challenges she faced that day, and what are the things that are sort of on her mind. If we truly believe what our faith teaches us, and there are some beautiful lines from both John Paul II and Benedict, and now Francis too, about how this faith is about this encounter with a real person, Christ. Mm-hmm. And so if we really believe that, then we know that if we're making room for that silence, we're making room for a real person, Christ, to speak to us. And so I think it's first and foremost, just as we would do if we are seeing a friend, like I'm seeing you, you and I were talking before the show that we hadn't seen each other in a while. Just sitting down and saying, "How are you?" and then just listening. And again, it's hard to sort of put meat on that, but I think maybe sometimes we try to make it more complicated than it needs to be.
We'll fill the void with a lot of talk. That's common. That's common among some couples. It's certainly common elsewhere. And silence is the difficult thing to come by in our world. It's difficult when you go out shopping. There's rarely a store I go into that isn't not only blaring music, but usually blaring something that I don't want to hear, right, or it's too loud. And I think I'm not sure what the marketing idea behind that is, because it usually drives me out of the store earlier than it would have otherwise. But it's very difficult to find that silence. And if you go home and there's three TVs on, or the phone's ringing, or whatever the noise happens to be, and it's not always auditory noise. I mean, it could just be things in your way, right? And then you're in your field of view that get in the way. It sounds to me like contemplation is not meditation. The distinction I've seen drawn before is that when we meditate, we're actually focusing on something in particular. When we contemplate, we are just being, we're trying to. And that's the most difficult part. And that's why Merton has written several books on the topic. He's got a chapter in New Seeds of Contemplation where he says this can be difficult and people get dejected and they get distraught. And he describes the kind of prayer life that Mother Teresa apparently endured, and that is it seems quiet and desolate, or the quieter you get, just all of a sudden your imagination starts running wild. And you think, well, this isn't what I want to think about. And the more you try not to think about it, the more you think about it, the right. more you focus on it. And this is where I think maybe the myth grew up, that this is for monks, because you've got to work at this 12 hours a day, not just a couple hours a day, not here or there, not in a retreat once a year.
Right, right. So, you know, it's interesting, in researching this topic for the talk I gave down in Kalamazoo, I discovered that it wasn't an encyclical, but a letter on the Rosary. John Paul II talked about the Rosary actually being contemplative prayer. I'd always thought of it simply as meditative. And so I think the Rosary, I think what he was getting at was sort of the repetition, which people from the outside can criticize as, oh, just rote prayer, and that actually is a method by which we sort of empty ourselves and let ourselves be, because it can kind of help take our mind off of all those things you were talking about, that it starts to run.
But it does, it drives it out. The air is only filled with your Hail Marys.
Right.
And yes.
So I've really thought and been pondering about that, the idea of the Rosary is contemplation, and I don't share this to toot my own horn, but what I've tried to do is, on the way home, I don't turn on the radio. I pray the Rosary. Usually I'm finished with the Rosary before I get home, so I
keep
the radio.
And that's when you turn on the Holy Family radio, right?
Well, this came up in the pledge drive. I joked about that's one time I'm not listening to Holy Family radio, because it's I need that time just to be. But it's sort of sometimes at cross purposes with driving, because I find myself being silent and then uttering something that I can't say on air, maybe at a driver going by. But
that's every confession of mine for the last 20 years right there. I think this seems to be seems to go around
yeah.
the whole anger while driving.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. So I think just if you can find those times where you have some captive time, where you're not able to necessarily do something else, that you can make that space. And that's one place I've tried.
Do you get to fly in your line of business? You fly to other cities? I found airplanes especially good for that. I mean, unless you're next to the guy singing to himself, eating a tuna sandwich or something.
I'm usually the guy that would be, you don't want to sit next to, because I want to have the conversation. I'm afraid of flying, so I'm hoping
I'm trying to talk to people.
No, I haven't had to fly yet since I got to Varnum, but in the law, so you do have to fly occasionally. Okay. But yeah, that is a time when you can do it. And I just think adoration is so key, and we're so blessed here in this diocese of Grand Rapids, and I know down in Kalamazoo, one of the things I did when I was preparing for the talk down in Kalamazoo, I know they have at least one place with perpetual adoration and a couple other places with adoration at different times. I think I'm preaching and teaching something that I need to live more myself, but adoration can be that time. Even if it's 20 minutes, 15 minutes on the way to work, on the way home from work, where you just let yourself be present, because he's there. We know that.
Even that short amount of time. Yeah. I know at St. Isidore Church, I've gone into their perpetual adoration chapel for maybe just 10 to 15 minutes after work. And I think you're right. And when I leave, sometimes I feel like, I'm really short changing this, but I really do feel like I've been you know, just in the midst of grace in our Lord, and it's been worth it.
Yeah. Well, I think Dorothy Day has some beautiful line about the tabernacle light, the red lamp. I think before she converted to Catholicism, that being such a sense of solace because it signified something that she, by grace, knew was there and present in the tabernacle. And what a great gift we have, and to be just there in front of Christ really present.
It's reassuring to see the candle.
Yes. Yeah, but I think also something you were saying about the stores, I have noticed that too. You go into stores and you've got the music blaring and things like that. I think we're afraid of silence. I know, I mean, I run away from it. How often do I have time when I could be reading or, again, just contemplating? Am I picking up my iPhone and checking for the latest status update on Facebook or something like that?
Yeah, I think you're on to something there about the fear. I see it in students that they're if they're not looking at their phones, which are, you know, just call them a phone. I'm not sure there's much more there than a phone. But if they're not looking at their phones, they may be having their iPods plugged in. And I've encountered students on the paths in the woods at Aquinas College, and it's me and one other person, and they'll just pass by, and they might not look up, or they're listening to their music. And I always remind them in class, it's really not a good idea to be out jogging alone or something with an iPod on through the woods. It's not, don't you remember the story of Little Red Riding Hood? You need to be more careful even at a safe campus like Aquinas. But on the other hand, it's a sign that, you know, maybe we don't want to be alone with our thoughts in this world. Yeah. Because when we do, we start to, you know, the truth speaks to us or God speaks to us, and we're convicted about things that we'd rather not have to work on changing.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. There was recently, I think he's an atheist, actually, Louis C.K., who's this comedian, was on, I think, Conan. And he was it was a very short little clip, but he was talking about how we are killing other people because we're looking and texting on our cell phones while we're driving these, you know, one-ton, two-ton behemoths. And he, in that little segment, kind of got to the truth of what you're saying. I mean, he talked about, we don't want to be alone. we don't want the sort of questions. Now, he's coming at it from a perspective of an atheist, and I think he sees the aloneness as hopelessness, and that's why we're trying to drown that out. But even though he's sort of misunderstanding it, I think he's getting at something that we see, and you're seeing in your students. I see in myself. I see in people I interact with. I see it in the education system. I'm sure you feel the pressure at Aquinas to let technology into the classroom, and sort of I see it in the school system my kids go to, where there's a one-to-one program starting in the middle school. Every student's going to be matched up with a tablet or a laptop.
So how could they not learn?
Right. Yeah. There's no possibility of learning, and if you don't have that technology, when everyone knows full well that the kids are exposed to that, you know, almost constantly outside of the school. It seems like to me that we should make our schools a sanctuary for silence and letting be. It's interesting. I have a friend who teaches at is in provost, used to be the dean, and teaches at the John Paul II Institute in D.C., and they had a prospective student who came to look at the institute. The institute doesn't allow you to have computers in the classroom. It's just a policy they've instituted. And this prospective student was getting a tour, and the tour guide gave him giving the tour said, "Oh yeah, no, you can't have computers in the classroom." And the student heard that, and he said, "I don't need to hear anything more. I'm coming." Hey, he kind of grasped what freedom that actually was going to give him in the classroom, and what freedom it was going to give his teachers. And I've heard similar things. I think Wyoming Catholic College, I'm pretty sure they don't allow computers.
I've heard that.
Yeah, so I think
– Or I want to say, or mobile phones.
Yeah, so they probably wouldn't get reception out there anyway, but you know, you don't have to be a Luddite and be against technology. I'm certainly not anti-technology, but I think we do need to understand the logic of technology. And this is something my friend David Schindler has written about. Like the logic of a cell phone is such that it's a device that really helps you to have a conversation while not being fully present. So you can be driving, you can be doing other things, grocery shopping, things like that. It's sort of built into the very nature of a cell phone is a not fully being present to the person you're talking to. Now, there's already that in a telephone in a certain extent,
but maybe it's different either the person on the other end of the phone, but the people who are next to you as well, right, while you're on the phone or you're texting and trying to talk.
Yeah. And I saw this much more, actually, in D.C. when I was a lawyer. It's been amazing and refreshing to me to be out to lunch with partners or other lawyers and not see them check their cell phones for emails and things like that. It was – you wouldn't go through a lunch in D.C. without someone – everyone there had BlackBerries. I think that's changing now, but checking his or her BlackBerry. What if that very important email came in? And it's very disruptive, and it's nice, it's refreshing to be here in Grand Rapids, where I think the culture is such that it's just a little lower key in the best sense of that phrase.
We took a poll of the Aquinas students here a year or two ago, and it was on response time. You know, how many office hours do you wish the professors had? If you give us a phone call, but how soon would you like a response? And at least for email responses, they wanted less than 24 hours.
Wow.
And so I was sure to tell them that even in graduate school, I instituted the Lord's Day as a day of rest, and I don't work, I don't check, I don't do anything except go to Mass and rest. And it's never really impacted my job adversely.
Yeah.
It didn't impact my studies adversely. I know not everyone is able to not work, at their place of employment on Sunday. But what I'm getting at then is, so we've talked about the world and the difficulties, and we all face them, and I can pretend to be holier than thou. Right now I'm showing Connor my track phone, which I like because it opens up and it looks like a Star Trek communicator, but it's actually about the least technologically complicated cell phone there is.
Pay extra for that, John?
I know you don't have to pay. You have to pay even less.
Well, I was wondering if they have to pay extra these days to find one.
All, exactly. It's a $10 phone right there. But there's days that I look over at somebody with the iPhone and I think, well, I'd love to have that. But I know it would happen. What would happen is what happens with my iPad at home. I'd be working until 9 at night because if I get those 5 emails out of the way, I'm done. And let's face it, it is kind of good for students when they're sweating bullets the day before an exam and they have a question and I can answer it quickly.
Yeah.
Right? But on the other hand, then where do we find silence for contemplation other than going to an adoration chapel? Or do we really just have to lock ourselves up in a room? What if our lifestyle isn't conducive to that? How are we going to get to the point where we even have the preconditions for contemplation?
Yeah, well, I think we're coming up here on Advent. Well, I guess when
that's long
yeah,
past.
Yeah, long past. We're coming up here on Lent.
Time travel here.
But we're coming up at times like Lent and Advent and things like that can be times where you can sort of be intentional about it. So, for instance, I think you do an examination of conscience and look at those things that are the noise in your life. And I think you made a great point earlier about it's not just auditory. I mean, there's noise in texts and emails, in things like tweets, which I still haven't quite figured out, and I don't know that I want to. But those are all a form of noise. And if those are the sorts of things that are becoming barriers to even beginning the path to walking towards a life that's more open to contemplation, what better time than Advent or Lent or any time? But I mean, those are really – I like those times because there's sort of times the church sets aside for us to prepare.
Right. The season is all about recollection. I know my – and I've said this on the show before – and talking with others, right? My wife and I, early on, when she entered the church as a convert, the second or third year we were married, after we were married, we just would put away our television for all of Lent, and it was amazing how much time we had in our hands, and we weren't really TV junkies. We weren't in front of it all the time, and it went from that very the good efficiency argument for look at what else you can do to suddenly you discover you really do have time in the day for reflection and contemplation. This may not be the ancient culture of the Hebrews, let's say, where we're an agrarian culture and there's an awful lot of downtime when it's not harvest time. It's not the 19th century, but there still can be time for that. But you have to make it, and it's priorities, and grace has to play a role because it's hard to put something aside.
Yeah.
It's hard to end a habit. That's why we call them habits.
Yeah. Well, one thing I've done not every Advent and Lent for the last few years, but I've done with some frequency, is I give up Facebook because I'm sort of a Facebook junkie. I don't blog, but Facebook kind of becomes like a semi-blog for me, where I post articles of interest and engage in discussion and stuff like that.
I commented on your Facebook page once. It was pilloried. That was the day I quit. I realized you really can't say anything substantial on a Facebook page. And I was horribly and grossly misunderstood. Now everyone will be, you know, they'll be tracing, looking back.
What did John say?
For this incident.
I'm going to have to go back and look.
Now I realize why I only use that for Catholic studies on my Facebook page.
So I give that up and just take a fast. I call it a Facebook fast. Try to use that as, and you do realize, I mean, for the first day or two, you almost have the withdrawal symptoms of someone who's given up caffeine or nicotine or something. So that's one thing. I think that the point you make about TV, the what you and Cassie have done during Lent, is a great one. One of the things we were conscious about when we moved from D.C. back to Grand Rapids last year was let's not continue the cable subscription. We got rid of cable, and we also put the TV in the basement. It's not in the main room, and so it just is. Because we don't have cable, I'm never like just sort of surfing the TV. And the fact that the TV is in the basement, I'm never going. I think I've watched maybe a handful of movies in the year and 2 or 3 months.
And when you talk to people, we got rid of the Dish Network a few years ago. And bought an internet TV that we used to watch movies. And just this past week, we moved it into an area of our house out of the main room. Yeah. Having a baby in the house was a prime mover in that, because it was always easy for us to go into a different sitting room. But now it was always kind of staring there like the eye of Sauron, even when it was off. And what a difference already! Just looking around a room and realizing the focal point is now chairs and couches pointing at each other for real human relationships. And I'm not sure, but psychologists are already studying this. Our Facebook relationships tend to make us crankier with our fellow man rather than happier.
I can see that.
Things they might have told us, and we would say, that's really nice. You see it posted on Facebook, and you think, well, doesn't she think she's special?
Right.
Well, that's very nice. There she goes bragging again about her children. But this is the kind of thing in a conversation, of course, we'd be talking about. And I wonder, you were talking about Pieper and some others earlier, and you got me thinking of a story by Isaac Asimov, speaking of atheists who have things that sometimes we can learn from. And it was about this future world where mankind had gotten so antisocial, they didn't even need to get together to breed. There was sort of one person alone in a cave. And this was just him trying to imagine way back in the 1940s what would happen to this world. Like, he already kind of saw this coming. Just take everything to the nth degree.
Yeah.
And where do we end up? And the remarkable thing about contemplation is, I think, that the closer we go to God, grow to God, we're automatically going to be drawn towards our fellows and our family, as you said, and vice versa.
Right. No, I think that's a great point.
Well, where should our listeners start then to develop the practice of contemplation? So we've talked about trying to bring opportunities for silence, and we've talked about the television and other things. So where would they start? Maybe books or thinkers? What might they read? Who should they talk to? What would you suggest?
Yeah, I've found Joseph Pieper to be very helpful. His book, Leisure is the Basis of Culture, I think is a great place to start. He's a very clear writer. I'm trying to think of specific books by Benedict Ratzinger that might be helpful. I'm not thinking of ones that are specific to contemplation, but I think can be sort of a stepping stone to it. He has a beautiful book of Advent sermons that he preached back in, I think, 68. 69, called What It Means to Be a Christian, and you could read it very. I mean, it's worth really pondering, but it's a short little book. I find that to be a very, very profound book, and I think it could be very helpful to understanding who Christ is and what Christianity is, and sort of helping to set into place the preconditions for contemplation. I also think the Catechism's little section on prayer is really, really helpful. I mean, I'm just amazed when I go back to the Catechism. This is not a document that reads like it was written by a committee. Even though there was a commission that kind of came together, I think a lot of it was written either by Ratzinger or Cardinal Schönborn of Vienna. And it is a beautiful synthesis of the faith. And the stuff on prayer in there is mind-blowing. And the stuff on contemplative prayer is short and beautiful. And I think that may be the place I would say to start. I mean, you can
find catechism.
In the catechism. I mean, I'm looking here in my notes. I think right around paragraphs 27:10 or so, you'd find this 27:12, 11 through 15 maybe. You'll find the sections on contemplation. And I think that's just really, really helpful. It explains the different forms of prayer. And that's just a great place to start. Even if you don't own a copy of the Catechism, you should. But if you don't, you can easily find it on the Vatican website, or I think is it the St. Charles Borromeo website. I mean, you just Google it.
So you can find it online.
You can find it. I would say print it out. I mean, I think sometimes, at least for me, reading these things on a screen can be difficult. And it's nice to have a piece of paper you can mark up and kind of
highlight. So if you're listening right now, you should follow this distraction, right, from your work and start surfing the Catechism for a few minutes. And
print out the section on contemplation, and I think that's a great place to start.
The phrase I remember from the Catechism is the word surrender. Surrendering to the Father, and I think that describes contemplation as well, putting yourself in the presence of the Father.
Yeah, I think that I actually have that quotation here in front of me. It says, the Catechism says, the contemplative prayer is the prayer of the child of God, of the forgiven sinner who agrees to welcome the love by which he is loved and who wants to respond to it by loving even more. Contemplative prayer is the poor and humble surrender to the loving will of the Father, an ever deeper union with his beloved Son. And I think that word surrender that you just highlighted, John, is so important. And I think that goes back to that idea of letting be. We're loved into being, and God continues to love us into being and loves us to the end. And if we get out of the way, I mean, it sounds so abstract, but I think it's it's simple, which doesn't mean that it's easy. But I think that we need to work on just getting out of the way and letting God speak to us, because he will. And there are going to be dry points too, at times too. You talked about Merton talking about that, and we obviously know from the life of Blessed Teresa of Calcutta that she had a long, I mean, long as in like I think 40 years of just sort of spiritual darkness. So I please God, don't let that be me. But
that's a burden I would not want to carry.
Yeah, but he will speak to us, and I think we need to ask. I think also too, another thing is to pray to the Holy Spirit for the gift of contemplation, praying to the Spirit to give us the gift to hear Christ.
One of the other things that Merton spends time on in that New Seeds of Contemplation book is not only does he have chapters on what contemplation is, he has chapters on what contemplation is not.
Oh, wow.
And so the Catechism is very helpful in telling you what it is. But Merton wants to make sure we know this is not he, at least in the 50s when he was writing that book, in the early 1961, the New Seeds book came out. But there was the term mental prayer. And he said, well, it's mental prayer, but it's not mental prayer, because that implies you're really thinking and you're putting something together and there's no need for grace or just being. It's more like following a recipe. If you meditate in a certain manner, somehow you can empty yourself, and that is not contemplative prayer. But he does say that the only way to get rid of misconceptions is to experience it. I mean, that's how powerful and awesome experiencing the presence of God is, because it's very difficult to communicate that to somebody else. How do you communicate to the infinite and in finite words? You really can't.
But I think there's an analogy to our own lives. We know that we can't sort of manufacture the Hallmark moment with our family. It has to sort of develop organically. It flows out of just being present. And that's I gave a talk recently on welcoming priests into our homes and talking about – I analogize my own life that I can't be a good father if I'm not present to my children. I mean, if I'm not – there are going to be things that take me away, Times Business and things like that. But if I'm totally absent, people are going to call me an absent father. I'm not really being a father at all. We need to be present to allow space for these things to happen. So if we're not even doing it, God, there's nothing for God to work with. We can't just manufacture that moment at home with our kids or with our wives. It's born of presence. And so we always hear that people talking about, well, it's all about quality time, not quantity. Well, I actually don't agree with that totally. I think a lot of it is about quantity, because quantity allows the space for quality, I think.
Okay.
I could be wrong, but I really do believe that. I mean, obviously God can work any sort of miracle he wants, but if we're not opening ourselves to him on a regular basis, if we're not listening, if we're not making room to hear him, we're not going to hear him. And you can't just do that by, I'm going to contemplate today and then I'll do it. Maybe I'll get back to it in a month or two. It has to be constant. It has to be a habit.
It's like any relationship then, isn't it? I mean, relationships have to grow over time. They're very tenuous in the beginning. You build them up slowly, and you can't just do that overnight, and you can't tend to a relationship only once in a while.
Right.
That makes sense. Well, I would like to return to somebody you mentioned earlier, David Schindler, because I know Schindler is a friend of yours, and I know theology of contemplation isn't that his specialty?
Well, he talks about contemplation quite a bit, yeah, and especially in his latest book, Ordering Love.
What could we learn from Schindler? What might you want our listeners to know about Schindler? I know you're a fan of his work, and he talks about the necessity of contemplation as we're talking about here. But he's maybe one of these people, along with, as you said, Joseph Pieper. That was one of my favorite books, in fact. These are the basis of culture. And I know you've mentioned von Balthasar, at least in your paper.
We
haven't talked about him. But I think I'd like to talk about Schindler for a bit. What could you tell us about him and why he'd be worth reading for our listeners?
Yeah, and I will say David is a great friend, and I can talk about the circumstances that led to that. That was pure grace that sort of led to that in Providence.
Sure.
He isn't an easy read, but I think he's a well worthwhile read. There's some things that there's an essay that you could Google that he gave to something called Crossroads. It's a group that Communion Liberation runs. He gave it in New York on the visit of Pope Benedict in 2008 to the United States. And he's on a panel discussion with Father Newhouse, Carl Anderson of the Knights of Columbus, and I think the then Nuncio in the United States. And I think that's a great place to start with his work, because it really encapsulates, I think, what he's trying to do. But the first thing one needs to know about Schindler is something I told a group of men recently, and that is, he is someone who does theology on his knees. Hans von Balthasar, spoke about how we needed theologians who did theology on their knees. And I really think David Schindler is that kind of man. He's a man who first prays and contemplates. He is not someone you're going to see quoted all the time in the news media. He's not in people's Rolodexes. And there's a reason for that, and I think part of it is his own choice, that you need time to think and pray through things. And so I think that for me it's hard to unpack or to untether his work from the person I know.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of what he's trying to teach, I think one of the things that I've learned really well from him is that receptivity is not the same as passivity. So we talk about being made in the image and likeness of God. And one of the things he emphasizes is that we're made in – how do we understand that? We can understand that as, oh, I'm God the Father, the Creator. Or we can understand we're made – you know, we're made through the Word, and we're made in the image of God, and we're made in the image and likeness of God, and that we image God most profoundly as the Son does, who receives his being from the Father. So that's not and that's not passive. That's an active thing, but it's receptive rather than sort of assertive or anything like that. And so I think one of the things I've learned from him is that we need to sort of listen, receive. Wonder is a big theme of his writing, that so much of Western culture, the ills of Western culture is born of a lack of a capacity to wonder and a room for wonder, and that when we I think contemplation and wonder go together, and so that we can the sheer gratuity of the fact that we are, that we exist. I mean, I don't know that I've gotten a lot of traction with atheist friends on this, but just to me, the question that Balthasar always talked about being so interesting is why am I rather than non-existent?
Why?
I mean, the sheer fact
it's a simple question that, as Chesterton often pointed this out, that pagans were really good at asking,
yeah.
And modern atheists necessarily are that they're not.
Yeah.
But the pagans eminently were. They would look at the world and they would say, but this is all here, but why is it here and why am I here and how does it work? And that's it seems a really obvious question that one would ask. Like, yeah. I could just as well not be here.
Yeah.
So could the world. An infinite God is I know the Baltimore Catechism would talk about this, and I'm not sure if this is really in the new the newer catechism, but the Catechism of the Catholic Church, that is what I mean to say. But that is, you know, God did not have to create the world. He wasn't lonely. So why? Well, he does it out of love.
Right.
And so as Chesterton would say, if you have a sense of gratitude, who is it to whom you have gratitude? To whom are you thankful? You must be thankful to somebody. Who are you saying thanks to?
Right.
I mean, if you feel thankful, there must be somebody to thank.
Right. No, I think that's a great point, and I think that's one of the points that Schindler, especially through his experience with both knowing Balthasar and reading Balthasar, really draws out, is this idea of wonder at the fact that we are. I mean, which seems so basic and simple, but it's just amazing. Why am I rather than not? Why do I exist? Why does all of this exist rather than not exist? And just when you just sit and think about that question, that begins. I mean, I think it begins to unravel certainties that atheists have. But it leads to more questions.
Well, and that's a big thing as a source of wonder, our existence. I just completed reading, on the recommendation of a friend of mine, Steve Ayers, Tremendous Trifles by G.K. Chesterton. And he said, well, that's my favorite book of Chesterton's. And I said, really? Because I've read a lot of Chesterton, but I just somehow I'd never read Tremendous Trifles. Well, it's about everything from pieces of chalk to a flower to anything, trying to demonstrate that there's so much wonder in the world if you just stop and pause and reflect on it. Because all these things don't have to be, but they are.
Right.
But not just reflecting on our own existence, but the trees and the clouds, everything.
Yeah.
When I think of wonder and you're connecting it to contemplation, that's a fascinating connection, I think.
Yeah.
So it would take contemplation maybe to see the Tremendous Trifles.
Right, perhaps. Right. But I think also, you know, this is something I'm not naturally an outdoorsy guy, but I think that to the extent that we can get out, especially in the beautiful summers we have in Michigan, out and just
all 3 days.
All three. Well, having lived in D.C. for 8 years, and I will take a Michigan summer and Michigan winter over the summers there.
Yeah, I lived in Charlottesville for three years. I feel your pain.
Well, that's right.
Yeah.
But just to get out and look at the stars and just the awe that inspires, that being open to that, I think is. Just an incredible beginning to the journey of contemplation. Walking on the shore of Lake Michigan, for instance, I think can be can be sort of an occasion of that grace that begins this journey of contemplation.
I sometimes realize that I've gone months without looking up. And I know as a kid, I was fascinated by astronomy until I encountered what higher math actually was. I thought maybe that was my vocation, was to be an astronomer. I was fascinated with it. I had the telescope, then a bigger telescope, then a bigger telescope. But the whole nine yards, I would go to these planet fests in California down at Caltech. This is when the Voyager spacecraft was making its way through the solar system. And I mean, I was really into it. And I think that's just part of that childhood wonder that you look up and you think, wow, just the very existence of those stars. And yet now as an adult, you know, I'll go months without even looking up in the city.
Yeah.
And that's unfortunate.
Yeah.
Maybe that'll be my Lenten. I'll look up more.
Yeah. Well, that brings us to mind, actually, a neat experiment that the Washington Post did. I don't know if you've ever read about this. They had, I'm going to forget his name, but one of the great current violinists play in a subway station, in a metro station, about 6 years ago, play his very, very expensive violin. And I don't know if it was Bach he was playing. I don't know if there'll be links with the show, but I'll make sure I get you the link. But he played it, and no one noticed it, really. People just kept walking by, and this was busy. It was during the morning commute, except for children. There were a number of children, and they actually have video of it, and they stopped and listened. And there's actually, I think, part of the video shows a child like tugging on his mother's sleeve, trying to stop her so he could listen more. Yeah. And that, I think, also brings, I think, another practical piece of advice in terms of this is listening to the great music. I am certainly no classical music aficionado. I don't really know much. But I think just listening to the great works, most of us have access to things like Pandora or Spotify where we can listen to it.
Pandora is excellent for that kind of thing. Yeah. Once you're done shaping your channel on Pandora, it's only giving you the good stuff.
And you can learn, you can hear new things that you hadn't heard before. So I think, and we have, you know, we're one of those lucky places. I think we have Fine Arts Camp, which you Fine Arts Radio, which you should only listen after hours, so you're not listening to it while Holy Family's on. But we have a classical musical station here, and I think that can be a real.
Oh, we have in Grand Rapids. We have a wonderful symphony, and the Grand Rapids Opera, which I enjoy. Well, this year with our baby not enjoying the opera.
Yeah, that's a little more difficult.
But someday again, that will occur, I'm sure. And all of that, I'm blown away by the human creativity and human creativity over the ages. And especially when you mention classical music or Baroque chamber music would be my favorite. And because it's always upbeat, and I guess that, you know, that's what I want. And I love the Baroque era of church architecture and art as well. And there's kind of a holistic sense there. About what's beautiful that I find really, really attractive. And, well, Connor, it looks like we are heading towards the end of our time here. They were flashing me a sign in the booth there a second ago. And so I would like to give the guests the last word in case there's anything you'd like to mention, plug, talk up, invite people to, whatever you'd like to leave our listeners with.
Yeah, I guess two things. One, one opportunity I think that we are one area that sort of goes along with wonder and contemplation that we started to touch on here at the very end is beauty and art. And I think that that's a way that we can sort of enhance our senses and make ourselves open to contemplation. And so we should find those opportunities. And maybe one plug I would put in is for people to try out the Divine Liturgy at St. Michael, the Archangel Ukrainian Catholic Church, in full union with Rome. They have a 10:30 Divine Liturgy service on Sunday mornings. You'll really be touched by beauty there. I think also I would say there's a great program that Mark Postma and Mike Tober have started, Authenticum, which you spoke at the inaugural lecture, Authenticum.
Yes, yes.
It's the first Thursday, I believe, of every month at Sacred Heart Parish in the basement down on the west side. And they are doing great work there.
They really are.
So I would put in a plug for going to Authenticum. They have a little happy hour beforehand to start at 6:30. 7 is the talk. And it really is an opportunity to immerse yourself in the beauty and riches of the Catholic tradition. And I think begin to reclaim so much that we've lost over the last 50 years that we lost touch with. And so I would really put in a plug for Authenticum.
I appreciate that. I think beauty is the right track to follow here. Well, you've been listening to Faith and Reason on Holy Family Radio. I'm Dr. John Panero, your host. We've been talking with Connor Dugan, who's counsel at Varnum Attorneys. I want to thank you for listening, and I ask you to return to the program here at the intersection of faith and culture. Thanks, Connor.
Thank you, John.
You've been listening to Faith and Reason with your host, Dr. John Panero, on Holy Family Radio. If you'd like to listen to this program again or share it with a friend, audio copies are available online at holyfamilyradio.net. Dr. John Panero is Associate Professor of History and Director of Catholic Studies at Aquinas College in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Faith and Reason is brought to you by Holy Family Radio. I'm your program producer, Michael Fiorenzo. Join us next time as we connect the riches of the Catholic intellectual tradition to daily life. Thanks for listening.